usual, I have a bigger pile of questions than I'll be able to get to. So I just picked out ones to discuss first, either because I was in the mood to talk about this, or maybe some things I thought were a little, you saw this thing, I don't know, no particular reason. So if I didn't get to your question, don't take it personal. And, maybe I'll have to come back. You know, next time we'll... But then when I come back, you'll submit new questions, and there's no telling what's going to happen. So I'll start with a light question, just for the fun of it. I have heard rumors that the yeshiva would like to open a branch in Lakewood. Even if this rumor is false, would the yeshiva consider doing this? We get killed in Lakewood. If yes, why? Isn't the yeshiva into bringing Torah to places that are lacking? And B'liya and her Lakewood is bursting with yeshivas. They opened up like a new yeshiva a year, I think, in Lakewood. Why shouldn't we want to do one too? You know, in theory, I don't really think it's practical. You know, but maybe near Lakewood, we do have a yeshiva near Lakewood. How much you're getting from Lakewood, I don't know. But in theory, we've been approached, actually, by people who think that there's an audience for us in Lakewood. It's not many, many families have moved into Lakewood over the years. It's not just the BMG community anymore. And they want a school that has maybe a little bit more serious secular and a little more, I don't know what you'd say, less right-wing, I guess, what they want. If we were to consider such a thing, it's not because we need to bring Torah to Lakewood. You know, it's certainly that might be a primary goal of our bus is Torah, but, you know, we opened up a yeshiva in Brooklyn not because we needed to bring Torah to Brooklyn. You know, and we opened up a yeshiva in Muncie, although it's no longer there anymore, not because we needed to bring Torah to Muncie, but rather because there's an audience that we could reach and we feel we have something to offer. And the yeshiva always called it manpower, and some of those Talmidim will be inspired and they'll become our B'chei Torah themselves. So it's a worthwhile project. But whether we're actually considering anything in Lakewood, the answer is not at this time. Okay, is our Batzis Torah cut out for everyone? If not, why is someone in yeshiva for 14 years? I think that's really an excellent question. My answer would be, Einochanami, not everyone is cut out for our Batzis Torah. Therefore, a lot of people should be in yeshiva for more than 14 years. There is a... seems to be a feeling, I've encountered this throughout our system, that the reason to stay through the yeshiva for all these years is because you're going to be, it's like, you know, professional training. You know, you want to be a doctor, so you have to go to medical school, and then you have to do, you know, a residency and internship or whatever, and you specialize, you do this, and therefore you have lots and lots of training. But if you're not going to be a doctor, you don't have to go to medical school. But the problem is that Torah isn't medical school, Torah is life. And if you're not grounded in Torah, then you're not going to have a Torah life. So what does that have to do with our Batzis Torah? We happen to believe that the world as it is now has a tremendous need for my Batzis Torah. Only a small segment of the Jewish population, with all the growth in Torah, is still being reached. And if a person has the capacity and the capability, that's the Ritzon Hashem. That's his obligation. Therefore, if a person feels he is cut out for it, that might provide him certain motivations and incentives to improve himself and so on and so forth. But if you think about it, a person who's, if he's not going to be a Marbitz Torah, and he's going to be out in the workforce, he's going to be facing more challenges that are pulling him away from Torah. He's going to be working in an environment that's certainly not, you know, conducive or friendly to Torah, and you have to maintain your standards, maintain your commitment, and continue to be a Ben Torah. That's so hard if you don't have the background and foundation. So really, I think if a person thinks he's not cut out for Batzis Torah, that's really all the more reason to stay in yeshiva, make sure that when he does go out into the workforce, that he's ready. In terms of the being cut out for Batzis Torah in the first place, there happens to be a wide range of ways that a person can contribute in terms of our Batzis Torah. You know, not everyone may be cut out to be a teacher, but maybe you could be a financial person, an administrator. Maybe you're more better with adults. You're better off being a rav or a kiruv worker. You know, there are different ways and means of participating. So a person shouldn't have a monolithic view that there's only one way to be a Marbitz Torah. There might be more But having said that, I can't say that everyone will find a place, and it's for everybody, and many people, their Avodas Hashem is to do something else. I will say is that you probably don't have to make that decision yet. You know, you guys are presumably all within your first 3 years at high school. Regardless of whether you're going to be a Maris or not, you still have to become a Talmid Chacham and a Ben Torah and a Bal Musar. And you have to shtag and grow. And if you're not sure, so you don't have to be sure. You know, but it shouldn't affect your commitment to your learning, to your growth, and so on. And as time goes on, you'll sort these things out and come to your conclusions. I know a fellow Talmud in Queens. He's actually in the Kollel now. That he somehow had this idea that he can't stay in learning because he didn't think he was cut out to be a Marbet Torah. And he told me he was at an oneg at Rabbi Harris's house Friday night. Rabbi Harris spoke about this and it changed his whole perspective. So I still don't know if he's going to be a Marbet Torah, but he's learning in Kollel now. He's been in Yeshiva in Queens. He was in the branch for 3 years in Queens for probably 8 or 9 years, you know, and so on. Baruch Hashem, he's going to be a Ben Torah, Tamachah, whatever he ends up doing. So I told Rabbi Harris this. He said he didn't know people listened in these onegs. Okay. Is the fact that there are so many Talmidim in Queens and therefore it is hard to have a close relationship with the Rebbe and B'di'eved, or do we feel that the Pilbuch HaRaim is worth it? I didn't really get the Tut Stadim of the Shaila because even if the Pilbuch HaRaim is worth it, it doesn't make it not a B'di'eved. not the Hakira here. But I think having a relationship with the Rebbe is a very big plus. And it's something that it is achievable in Queens. So in Hanami, it's harder, because of the number. The biggest, I always say this, we have these welcoming breakfasts. I don't know if I want to give away my speech at the welcoming breakfast, but hopefully you'll forget it by then. And then when I say, oh, yeah, I think I heard that before, so it'll be okay. But I think, the biggest difference in terms of that between Queens, because of the numbers, because of the structure, because there's a lot of older fellows, is that you have to be much more proactive. You know, if you don't reach out, unless you get yourself into trouble, but if you're basically a solid citizen and more or less doing what you're supposed to be doing, and you mind your own business and you don't reach out to anybody, you could just go through your years in Queens and nobody will ever say hello. I mean, they'll say hello, especially if you stand in the Shabbos like Shabbos, but not much more than that. So you wouldn't have a relationship necessarily with the Rebbe. So you need to sort of be proactive. Ultimately, I think that is healthy because life is like that. You can't just go through life having people sort of leading you along the way. You know, at a certain point in time, you got to be proactive and take responsibility. So I think there is a plus to that. There's a memra in Rabbi Amar Rabbi Chanina. It says Harbi Lamati Rabosai. Yoser mechaverai mitamida yoser mikula. So I think Rabbi Lubani, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's from Rameir Chadash. We heard this line that he said, "Nu, if it's mitamida yoser mikula, so what are you wasting all your time with the rabbeim and the chaverim? Just go straight to the talmidim." So obviously, you can't do that. It's a sequence. After it's harbel and rabosa, and then it's mechaverai yoser mikula. Then you can have talmidim. You grow from the talmidim. So look at that sequence. So Harlan Rabbah said, what's the next step? Yosem Mechaverai. Why is that so? He says, because comes a certain point in your development when you get more growth from the Chaverim than you do. It doesn't mean you shouldn't have a Rebbe then also. Of course you have to have a Rebbe. But you become a little more independent and you're dealing with your peers more and so on. So there's a process. The truth is the system that we have in Chafetz Chaim was not, planned. There was no architect. Akadosh Baruch Hu, I guess, is the architect. It wasn't that, the Rashiva sat in his office in Queens and said, how about we make this branch system and people will learn 3 years in the branches and then come to Queens. It kind of evolved by itself. And, in the early years of the branches, they had first year and second year shurim in Queens too. And what ended up happening was that people liked the idea of going to the branches and this and that. And, you know, when you're in Queens, you talk it as a first year, second year, but you also have color guys and you feel like, you know, you're an afterthought, you know, at the bottom of the totem pole. And people like to go to the branches and so on. But I think, and then the yeshivas needed chizuk, so the yeshiva gave them permission to have a branch blotcher, you know, so they could have all piecemeal, you know, happened, put together, you know, and it came about. I remember there was no such thing as branch blotcher when we started in Miami. You know, they get credit for it. It happened pretty soon thereafter, but, you know, they didn't, you could be in a branch, you didn't get credit. So then people didn't want to stay the third year. So they felt they needed it. They also thought it was a good idea. Okay, so we'll give credit, took out the base measures. You know, things happened. They evolved along the way. So, but I think it's a good thing. I think the system worked out just right. Because I think when a person is first leaving high school, it is a good idea to be in an environment where you don't have to be so proactive and people will help you. And it's better to be in an environment where the yeshiva is geared towards your needs, where you're not swallowed up in the whole scale of people 10 years older than you and 8 years old have different needs. Married people, you know, it's so when you're in the sort of like the formative years of Beis Medrash, when you're first starting to strike out on your own, I think people are much better off being in the yeshiva that's geared specifically to the needs of those Talmidim coming to Queens. There are B'di'evads involved, but there's a lot to be gained. And I think even relationship with the Rabbeim can be had, but you have to practice. I personally was not so good at that. I'll tell you this story because Rabbi Harris doesn't let me tell it at the opening breakfast anymore because he's sick of it. I figure if a few years go by, I could start telling it again. But so I could tell you the story. That the when I came to the yeshiva in Queens, I always have to calculate the years. My fifth year in the yeshiva was the first time I had a private conversation with the Rosh Yeshiva, you know, outside of like a session or a share or something like that. So I felt whatever it was, I wasn't this kind of guy. A few times I tried, you know, they would hack the Rosh Yeshiva after davening. My shkafim would be crowding around. So a few times I tried to crowd around there. I ended up in the back. I couldn't hear what the yeshiva was saying. I just didn't have it in me. I wasn't like, you know, that type, a little shy. A little, like, wasn't such a pusher. So what happened? My fifth year of the yeshiva, I had a job managing the work-study program in yeshiva. And the way it worked then, it's different now, but the way it worked then was we had these timesheets. You had different jobs were assigned. And you had to give them the timesheets how many hours you worked. So the person who had the job before me told me that since yeshiva guys are so talented and they're, you know, God's gift to the world, so you're allowed to put down more hours than you actually worked because a yeshiva guy could accomplish in an hour what it takes another guy an hour and a half. It sounded a little strange to me, but if that's what yeshiva's talk, okay, but it seemed to me, but it can't be like indefinite. Like you can't put down 1 hour and take 100 hours. There's got to be some limit, you know. So I asked for some guidance. I spoke to the yeshiva's secretary. I said, maybe I need some guidance on this psak. How do you implement it? So I got a message back to her. Yeshiva would like to speak to you right now. If you could please go to the yeshiva's house. So I went to the yeshiva's house, and the yeshiva said, Sheker, Geneva, you better not let anybody do that. So that was my first private conversation with the yeshiva. By the way, I later found out, I'm pretty sure, how this psak came about. Because the lashon that was told to me was they give this job to every Tom, Dick, and Harry, but a yeshiva guy is... I found out later that a few months prior, somebody asked the yeshiva the following shaila. If I work at a normal pace, it'll take me 2 hours to do the job. But I could rush my kishkas out and do it in an hour and a half. Am I mechuyev to rush? To which the Rosh Yeshiva answered, they give this job to every Tom, Dick, and Harry. You think they're rushing? Do the job at a normal pace. That's fine. That's kosher. So then the next step was the guy made the following application. If I'm allowed to do the job at a normal pace, what happens if I do rush my kishkas out? And I do a two-hour job and I have mistama, I'm allowed to claim 2 hours. Migu, that I could have done the job slowly. Then the next day, well, what do I have to rush for? I'm a yeshiva guy. So that became the that became the psak. So the moral of the story is, if you hear a psak that doesn't sound right, don't believe it until you go back to the original source. So you could accomplish without that, but it's definitely a plus, and people should try if they can, if they have the ability to be proactive. But there's many resources that you gain from the both the Pilbel Chaverim, for having the older Chaver around, having the Anhala, you know, things working to publish it together with the whole Olam, and there are many things that you grow when you're ready for it, when a person's up to that stage. If the goal in life is to be the best Jew possible and to get as close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as possible, how does Limud Gemara get us there? Or perhaps to rephrase the question, I imagine the question would agree that this probably should be some Limud Gemara, but that's pretty much what we do. Like 90% of the day, we do, you know, there's a Halacha Seder, we have a Musa Seder, you know, maybe a Vad here or there. Sometimes we have a Q&A and we interrupt the Limud Gemara. We do occasionally do other things, but it is obviously the bulk of what we do. And then in parentheses, besides the Masorah, because he doesn't want to just say, well, that's our Masorah, leave me alone. So, I think that's what I said last year. No, I think, again, there's probably, as in many things, and when you're talking about the Masorah, we don't necessarily have a full picture of all the ramifications and so on. So whatever I say here is not meant to be exhaustive of the subject, but just a little bit of our is that the Gemara itself is a tremendous tool, besides the halacha, to grow and to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And I noticed I had a few questions in the high school question and answer, like, why is the Gemara have to be so hard? You know, that was a question. And also, why we make such a focus on it? But Gemara is hard, and it isn't by accident. And growth comes from amelos. There's a exerting yourself with tremendous effort, and particularly what the Gemara really represents is, in a sense, you'd be a little philosophical about it, it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's way of thinking. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us the Torah. Of course, it's interpreted by Chazal, and to go through all the sources, but Chazal are also connected, you know, to that way, and by being amel and working hard in the Torah, we absorb into ourselves both the concepts of the Torah and the thinking process of the Torah. So we become a more Torah-dicker person. And everything, every decision we make in life, everything we do is ultimately affected by who we are. And the more we think like a Kadosh Baruch Hu, if I could be so bold as to put it that way, or perhaps a less dramatic term, the more Das Torah we have, it's a term we use today, then the better our life decisions are going to be in every aspect of life. And including the decision to ask for Eitzes, which is a decision too. People have to know that. So there is, the Limud HaTorah ultimately elevates and raises the person. And, you know, Chazal say, Torah may be the days of heroes. And they weren't specifically talking about Musar. Mr. Shem says there's Torah in general, and there's Musar specifically. The Torah itself connects a person, elevates a person, makes him more of a Torah-dicker thinker. You know, there are so many stories that people go to Gedolei Torah for what you might think is practical advice and things that these people have no expertise in, and they get amazing answers. Okay, maybe they're very smart people, but that's not the only issue. It's their thinking process is refined and elevated by the Torah. And it can be frustrating, but it's important to know that the process itself is worthwhile. You know, a person could be amel b'Torah and not get the answer. But the process of the amelus and sort of slugging out the wrong shot and getting there, it's also growth in Torah. And there's schar for the amelus. There's a famous Maimer Chazal. It says, Anu amelim u'mekabim schar, v'heim amelim v'heim u'mekabim schar. And the Achronim asked the question, is that really true? People are amel, and they're mekabel schar. Maybe the schar that you get is ruchnius, they get gashmius, is nitzchius, is temporary. But people get schar. But the answer that Achronim say is they don't get schar for amelus. You get schar for results. If you hire a tailor to make a suit for you, and he measures and he does and this and he gets the material and he cuts it and he sews it, and there's a fire and the suit burns and never gets to deliver it to you, you don't pay him. But I did all the work. He didn't produce the suit. You're not going to get paid. Torah is not like that. You could spend an hour knocking your brains out trying to figure out pshat and tosis, and you didn't get pshat and tosis. You still get schar for that matter. So I actually learned that lesson from one of the biggest mistakes I made in my educational career. So I don't know. I almost destroyed Yeshiva Torah Chaim. I don't know if we'd be having this Q&A today, but in the early years of the yeshiva, we had a really, really big struggle of keeping our elementary school students for high school. We actually ran grades 7 through 12 together. In part, it happened historically, we thought it would help, and probably did help, but even with that, it was very, very difficult to keep the classes, and they would peter out, half the classes didn't last till 12th grade, and we couldn't get running, we couldn't get traction. There was a very strong culture in the city, the Dafka send out of town, and it was very, even though we ran the elementary school, it was very hard to beat that. And then we had this class coming up, coming out of 6th grade, coming into our 7th grade, that was a real opportunity for us. There were, I think, 18 boys in the class. None of the families had strong allegiances to other yeshivas. All like middle-of-the-road families. We had a legitimate shot at every one of those kids. And this had to be our turnaround class. If we could get this class to stay, we could turn things around. If not, who knows, you know, what it's going to be. So I understood, you know, that a lot of the parents in the class were very, very concerned that they should have a quality secular education. So we happened to have one like really superstar teacher at the time. I won't exactly comment on the other teachers. And so he taught English and social studies, so I assigned him to teach the 7th grade English and social studies half their afternoon. So I figured this is going to be great. Rabos machshavos belevish nebuch, but the guy got killed in a car accident in October, beginning of the school year. Okay. Now we have to hire a replacement. So I got a resume from a guy who played basketball from one of the major colleges. I don't remember which one. He was drafted in the second round of the NBA draft by Milwaukee Bucks. He didn't make the team. He played professional basketball in Italy for a year. And then he was invited to the Phoenix team for their training camp, and he didn't make the team there either. On his resume, as personal references, he had the coach of Milwaukee and the coach of Phoenix, you know, contacts. But I look at his thing, he had no teaching experience, you know, he had a degree, but you know, I don't know. Like, I interviewed a different guy, had quite a bit of experience, had a nice resume. The guy I hired turned out to be an absolute disaster. He may have had a resume, but he was a nasty, burnt out, obnoxious fellow. The kids hated him, the parents hated him, and I hated him. And kids were complaining every day. It was a disaster. We were thinking maybe we should fire him and try to get a third teacher in the middle of the year. We figured this is, we better now. Let's just make it to the end of the year and see what we can do. So if it would have been 8th grade, that would have been it. It would have been all over. The whole class would have been gone. It was 7th grade. The parents summoned me, administration, to a meeting at the end of the year. It was organized by the parents to give all their complaints and so on. I won't mention the name, but the host of the meeting told me after the meeting, as we're walking out, he said, I'm giving you guys 1 year to put your act together, get your act together, but if not, my kid's going to Skokie. His kid is a Muslim of the yeshiva, by the way. So that was it. So it was such a big mistake. I should have hired the basketball player. I don't know what I was thinking. What are you afraid of? Let's say he's not a good teacher, and he doesn't teach. So what's the big disaster? So for 7th grade, they won't learn too much English or too much social studies. Okay. But I would have told him, if the class gets antsy, gets out of hand, take him out to the basketball court and show him a few moves. This guy was that close to the NBA. I'm sure he was unbelievable. He could have done things that blew your mind. You think the kids are complaining to their parents about this teacher? You think the parents are upset because they had educational tightness in the way that he was teaching the class? You think 7th graders even tell their parents what the teacher's saying in class? It's only when they have a complaint. So they are very unhappy complaining to their parents. They would be happy. What are you learning? What did you do at school? Nothing. What happened at school today? Nothing. What's going on? Nothing. Are you everything okay? Great. That's it. That's your conversation with a 7th grader. So I had no problems. If he was a good teacher, I'd keep him. If not, we'll get somebody else in next year. So it was the big, big, big mistake. I just don't know what I was thinking. I almost destroyed the class by extension the yeshiva. Baruch Hashem, we did have a very good year in eighth grade, and we did keep most of the kids, and it did become our turnaround class. But that was the story. But I realized, this basketball player, he had to be extremely talented. To be able to be drafted in the NBA and I get two chances to make an NBA team, he had to be unbelievably talented. But he also had to put in tons of work. You cannot make it to the NBA just on talent. There's a bunch of other guys out there who are also extremely talented. So you got to do the practice and the workouts and the training and the endurance and the strength training and weightlifting and running and all the stuff that I don't know what they do, but hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and hours, thousands of hours over the years, practicing, training for that ultimate goal to be in the NBA. And there's some other guy who's just a little bit better than him, who's sitting on the bench of the Phoenix Suns making $1.2 million a year, and he's applying to teach social studies in Yeshiva Torah Chaim. And he didn't even get the job. That's Haim Amelim Ve'enim Mekablim Shchar. All the work that he put into that basketball, it didn't do anything for him. That's Haim Amelim Ve'enim Mekablim Shchar.
Did they hire him after?
No. But then we already had a regular teacher. It worked out. But the idea is, the amelus process, though, is a tremendous growth vehicle. And that's why I'm sure a very important aspect of why HaKadosh Baruch Hu made it such that it's so hard to get in. It requires the amelus and the Iyun and the Vana and so on. And that will... make you more Tardika person. You imbibe it; it becomes part of you. And therefore, now how you exactly factor in how much of it—that you rely on the Sora. Who says it's not this way, not that way, a little more, a little bit less. But just conceptually, in the broader terms, I think that's a very important part of the puzzle. Okay. A little bit of arichas here. I'll just paraphrase the question. But the question basically is, there are billions probably of people out there who are adherents of other religions. You have Christians, you have Muslims, and you have probably all kinds of other things. I don't even know all the Buddhists, Hindus, whatever they are. And presumably they all think they're right. They're not following the religion because they think they're wrong, and we think we're right. So what makes us so sure that we really are right? And, if we really want to be sure they're right, shouldn't we be looking into all these religions and examining them and comparing them, comparative religion study, and find out, what the emphasis is? There's no question that lots of people could think things are right that are not right. And even like narrowing that focus, we see that within our own circles too. Forget about looking at other religions. We have different people who have different views on different things in life, and each side thinks they're right. So, the fact that people think they're right by itself is not necessarily impressive. Ultimately, it happens to be, by the way, that at least two of the major religions the world also think we're right. Islam and Christianity is based on the Torah. Then they added things, changed things later. So the burden of proof is really on them, not on us. But the fact of the matter is that if you have certain foundations that have clarity, you're not mechuyev, to make yourself crazy, so to speak, to second guess yourself, and examine other things. You do have stories of people who do that, or people farked. You have stories of gerim who come to Yiddishkeit, have to examine other things. But the yisod haDavar is that we have enough foundation within ourselves to know the truth, that you don't have to be paranoid or neurotic about what you see. And there are certain basic things. I don't know if I'm here to give a whole speech on all the, you know, different rayas, but the fact that I guess the most fundamental one is really the proof of Mesorah. We it says in the pasuk, "Hayniyaka davar hazeh anishma kamahu." Hashem am kol lekim yadar mekol mitoch esh kasher shemata tova yechi. So the pasuk says, "Has there been any other experience in the history of the world that's like Maimon Har Sinai?" Oh, hanishma kamahu. It says, "Hayniyaka davar hazeh." Oh, hanishma kamahu. What does it mean, hanishma kamahu? It means that anybody else makes such a claim. And the answer is no. There's no religion that makes such a claim. The revelations of all religions were always private, small numbers, individuals. Right? Muhammad had his revelation by himself. There wasn't millions of people. You know, the Christians had said there were a few of them. I don't know, 12, 6, I don't remember. I don't know what they said. But they don't make millions of people. Because you can't sell that. If millions of people were there, right, you're going through the generations. Millions of people were there. If you're telling me my grandfather was there, so how come he never said anything about it? You can't sell that. If you say, look, I had a revelation, you could be persuasive, you could be this, you could get people to follow you. And then we have this unbroken Mesorah. You know, somebody pointed out the New Testament has more, so to speak, girsa changes, girsa variations, like by a factor, I think almost 100 to 1 over what, you know, we have from the Gemara. Kaisel is so aduk, and we were most nefesh to keep everything the same way that it is, generation. So that is a very powerful force, really, against any other religious claim. And Mimela, like, there's a danger in getting involved in too much of this kind of stuff, because it can be molded doubts and create confusions and so on. Sometimes a person, it's interesting, Rav Victor Miller wrote some books where he does talk about some of these comparative religion things, and he was sort of delegated by Gedolei Yisrael to do this, to study other religions. I felt he was Roy Lekach, and he'd be able to address it and so on. And there are people who do it. A person could look into that if they feel they have the need. But the fact of the matter is that when you have a foundation, it's not necessary to compare every opposite, every other potential. When you have enough minei bei basis, then you know the truth. Okay, a couple of things to this one. The Rambam says that complete tshuva is only when a person is in the exact same nisayon, makam nisayon, and isn't nichshal. If so, why do we dive into Hashem that He does not give us nisyonos? Granted, it's typically good to avoid nisyonos, but if a person needs kapara and he's able to pass the nisayon sekhtarim, shouldn't we dive in for the nisayon? So first of all, it doesn't say in the Rambam that you have to have the nisayon. The Rambam says, Yodea talumos knows that if you would be faced with the same nisayon, you would pass. That means the degree of azivas hachet and charat and whatever it is that's in your heart would mean that you would pass that nisayon. Because Baruch Hu knows that with or without the nisayon. It doesn't really say in the Rambam that you have to actually have the nisayon and pass it, to have a kapara. But the truth of the matter is, if there would be no nisyonos in life, there would be no purpose to be here. The whole idea of life is to face the nisyonos, face our weaknesses, improve them, our challenges, misakan our midos, grow, develop, become a greater person. I think there's a classic shmuz in the Rosh Hashiva Zatzal on this point. It says in the beginning of Vayetze, Kadosh Baruch Hu appeared to Yaakov Avinu, and he identified himself as Elkei Avraham v'Elkei Yitzchak. So Rashi brings down that Kadosh Baruch Hu is not miyached shmo ala tzadikim b'chayehem. He doesn't call himself Elkei somebody while they're alive. Why? Because a person has bechira, and therefore they could become a Rasha. And how does it look? It's a bizarre that Hashem's name was connected to a person who ended up becoming a Rasha. I remember actually when I was still in Florida, they had this huge ceremony dedicating, I don't know, it was a road or a bridge in honor of some retired politician. And then 3 days later, he was indicted on all kinds of corruption charges and everything else. And they quietly rechanged the name of the street. So it can be embarrassing. So why was it they said, okay, Yitzchak? So Rashi brings down that Yitzchak was old, he was blind, he was confined to the house, and there really wasn't any chance that Yitzchak was going to go off to Dara. He didn't have much of a Yitzhara anymore. That was the story. The end of the parsha, when Yaakov is talking to Laban, he says, Elokei Avram Aviu Pachad Yitzchak. He doesn't say Elokei Yitzchak. So Rashi says, why didn't Yaakov say Elokei Yitzchak? Because Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Miyachid Shema Tzadikim B'Chayehem. And then Rashi asks the obvious question about HaKadosh Baruch Hu did it. So it says, Yaakov Yorei. Yaakov was afraid to do it. So the Taz asks the question, what do you mean Yaakov was afraid of? HaKadosh Baruch Hu did it. What are you afraid of? So one of the answers the Taz says is that Yaakov was afraid that it would be a pegam in kibud av v'aim. Because if I say, okay, Yitzchak, I'm implying that Yitzchak really doesn't have any challenges anymore. He doesn't have any nisyonos anymore, and he's not growing. So what's that? It's like a live, dead person. So Shiva pointed out, okay, maybe that's a shtickle pegam, but the title, Elokei Yitzchak, is one of the most amazing titles in the history of the world. How many people earn such a title? Hint, 3. Okay? So Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. So David HaMelech didn't get the title. He was jealous of that. So it is an amazing compliment to Yitzchak that he's roi for the title of the Kei Yitzchak. And Yaakov was still afraid, yeah. It's an amazing... On the other hand, I'm the Meisim being mashma that he isn't growing anymore, and I don't know. I'm not sure. That's how vital, how important that is. So we need to have nisyonos. But that's a Kadosh Baruch Hu's job. Kadosh Baruch Hu will give us nisyonos that we need in the sense that we need it. Our job is to avoid chet and to accomplish good. And therefore, our job is to try to avoid... Maybe that's gufar nisyon, is to avoid the nisyonos. So our job is to minimize the nisyonos as best as we can. And Kadosh Baruch Hu's job is to decide what nisyonos to give us anyway. So we're mispala loli de nisyon because we want to do the right thing. We have to, therefore, we don't want to face challenges that we could fail. So Kadosh Baruch Hu will decide what challenges we could pass. But to ask for a challenge indicates we don't care enough about the chait. How are you so sure that you're going to pass it? So you can't ask for such a thing. Either, Rabbi, you have to ask to be protected. Kadosh Baruch Hu will do what he has to do. Is there any form of gaiva that a person should not worry about? For example, if a person is being motivated to learn an extra seder by the feeling he gets when others notice him, and wouldn't be learning if it were in private, should he stop the seder and try to eradicate the gaiva motivation, or not worry about it and focus on other areas? There's a concept of mitok shelo lishma ba lishma. You know, there are things that are motivated really by improper purposes, but it's a good thing to do. So mitok shelo lishma ba lishma. The Marsha says that mitok shelo ba lishma primarily works, although I think there's some concept even without it, but primarily works when a person is attempting to get to the milo lishma. If you're happy with the shelo lishma, that's no good. You know, that's a chayt. But you want to, but a person has to be real and understand that he's not perfect. So there are always going to be lo lishma motivations. My answer sort of is a person should worry about the gaiva. If he feels he's being motivated by gaiva and by approval of others, he should worry, but it doesn't mean he should stop what he's doing. If he's doing something that's good, then it's good. So just because there's a bad, you know, a person could have a negiyah and be right also. So just because you have a motivation that's shelo lishma doesn't mean that it's the wrong thing to do. So that's an examination. Is it right for you or wrong for you? You could sometimes be doing something that's wrong for you. Maybe something you can't handle is too much. Okay, fine. You have to make cheshbonos. Maybe be shaletz if you're not sure and find out. But don't not do the right thing just because you have improper motives. But you should be concerned about those motives and try to be misacking them and try to do the right thing for the right motives. And Lemaisa, you know, there. You know, perhaps in this kind of scenario, a person should try to be working on doing things privately when people don't notice. Try to push himself. You know, wait a minute. I'll dafka try to, you know, as a plan. Try to learn that extra seder, you know, in private, nobody's even though you don't feel like you're doing it. You know, you see it doesn't work, so okay, you do it in public again. You know, maybe half of it in private, a little bit. You try one day a week. You know, figure takbulas. So you shouldn't be dependent on the reinforcement of the guy. So a person should not be satisfied with allowing a bad midah to motivate him to do the right thing. But it doesn't mean that you shouldn't do the right thing. It means you should do the right thing and try to work on becoming more lishma. Let's see what else we have. A few more minutes. I really shouldn't answer this question. But there's a lot of leitzanus that goes on in yeshivas. On the one hand, it could be a good outlet for guys. On the other hand, it creates certain negativities or lack of seriousness. Example, leitzanus about certain things the yeshiva does or certain policies of the yeshiva. What are the guidelines for kasha leitzanus? I think I'm guilty of a lot of leitzanus myself. So, you know, I don't know if I should be answering this question. But I do think that there is a place for humor. I will tell you that we once had the opportunity to talk to an old Slobodka Talmud, and he said that when Rav David was in the Kolol in Slobodka, if you looked at him casually, you would think he was a leitz. He's always joking around and this, but if you listen carefully, every joke had a message. And we told it over to the Rosh Yeshiva. The Rosh Yeshiva was so happy. I don't remember seeing the Rosh Yeshiva. He was practically jumping up and down. I said, why was the Rosh Yeshiva so happy? He says, because he tells jokes. The Rosh Yeshiva used to tell jokes. So he said, he didn't see Rav David doing it. Rav David maintained a very serious demeanor. And the Rosh Yeshiva never told jokes. So I always felt a little guilty. He said, Rosh Yeshiva, I felt I needed it. I felt the Talmidim needed it. But my father didn't do it. Now I found out he did do it in Slobodka. So he must have had a cheshbon. He said, when he came to America, since the cover of the Torah was so low, there's so many bizyonos, and people, you know, looked down at anybody who's learning Torah. He felt that if he joked around, it would give him more fuel to just a bunch of jokers. But be'etzem, it was okay. So that was the Rishiva's uptight. But lemaisa, sometimes a joke can be a vehicle for reducing resistance and getting a message. Of course, it could work for bad, too. But you can get a message across your joke. It can be an outlet. But the Yesod HaDavar is what crosses over into the line of Leitzanus, which is a very serious thing, is when humor is being used to reduce the kavod of something that needs kavod. If you're knocking kavod of mitzvah, kavod of a Talmud Chacham, kavod HaTorah, you know, you're taking away the seriousness of something, you know, that deserves it. Then that's a really serious thing. It can be a very destructive force. So, as Rav Shiva used to say, you never have the right to turn off your brain. You know, just because you like to joke and tell jokes, you have to think about what you're joking about. Not every joke is acceptable. And again, a person has to be careful. So I'm definitely not against jokes, but you cannot use humor or mockery as a vehicle to degrade something that really, you know, deserves covet. Do this one first.
Is it only used because people need it, or is it also used because it's
okay,
it's good?
No, probably because people need it. I don't know if it's... there is a... why is the firm world placing so much of an emphasis on throwing out smartphones or putting filters on smartphones? I would add computers too, than on Lashon Hara, for example. Isn't Lashon Hara so much more of a problem and much greater avera? Smartphones and internet in general, and smartphones in particular, are really the vehicle to achieve many, many averis. The averis is not isser smartphones. The averis is what do you do with a smartphone. So Lashon Hara is a great example. Once upon a time, Lashon Hara has always been a problem. Chazal already talked about it. But once upon a time, if you wanted to speak Lashon Hara, you had to find a human being to speak Lashon Hara to. Now, you couldn't just tell anybody, because some people will look at you, or you don't have a relationship with them, and you don't feel comfortable. Sometimes there's somebody else around, and you don't want to say it in front of him. So you had a certain number of opportunities to speak Lashon Hara. Then they invented the telephone. So now that you have a telephone, you don't have to see a human being. You can call them on the phone. So now it became so much easier to tell Lashon Hara. But telephones have their limitations. You know, let's say you're not near a telephone. They made the telephones with the long cords, but how long could the cord be? So if you're not near a telephone, you can't pick up the telephone and tell Lashon Hara. What if somebody else is using the phone? You know, you have the phone in the house, somebody else on the line, you have to wait until it's available. You know, you can't tell Lashon Hara. So then they invented cell phones. Before you get the smartphones, cell phones, you have your own private phone. It's with you all the time. You never have to wait in line. Right? You could be anywhere. Right? You don't have to be in close proximity of a telephone. The telephone comes with you. So how much more Lashon Hara was it? But, you know, you could call somebody up and they don't pick up the phone. You know, maybe they're on another phone call. You know, somebody else is telling them Lashon Hara. You have to wait in line to tell your Lashon Hara. So, we invented texting. So you could just text it and get the Lashon Hara right away. But, you know, texting is a little cumbersome. You have to text the letter. You only talk to one person at a time. So then we invented the internet. Now you have WhatsApp, you know, so you could tell Lashon Hara to all kinds of people at the same time. And not only that, if you have like 30 people in your WhatsApp group, any one of those 30 people who wants to tell Lashon Hara at any point of the day or night could speak and you'll get it. You'll be able to be Mekabel Lashon Hara. So, and that's not even counting people who put blogs and you know, or the social media. When Donald Trump tells Lashon Hara, he tells it to millions of people. Right? Millions of people are following his Twitter. So it's a the enormity of Lashon Hara on the internet and on smartphones is mind-boggling. So the premise of the question, we should be worried about Lashon Hara. Yeah, we are worried about Lashon Hara. That's one of the reasons why we're trying to limit and access and so on. So there are so many problems. It's not, you know, people sometimes only focus on the Gilui Arayos, you know, the pornography and the Nisyonos, which is also huge. Right? There was always stuff like that around, but it wasn't so easy to access. You wanted pornography, you had to go to a store and buy something, and it's very, you know, self-conscious until you break the barriers. You have to, it's an effort, you have to go walk, and maybe somebody will see you. You know, it's a tremendous barrier. So not that many people did it. Now you just, you could do it in privacy, any place you want, you know, relatively private, and get into the stuff. So it's a big nisayon. You know, we talked about Leitzanus, the king of Leitzanus is the internet. People mocking and destroying and dragging people down. So the reason why there's such a focus on the dangers of the technology today is goofy because they're so dangerous. It's not that there's a maisa avera of having a smartphone or a maisa avera of having internet. It's a tool. But it's a tool for everything. And just like it's a super effective tool for positive things, it's equally super effective tool for negative things. And we talked about before about avoiding nisyono. So it's not like, you know, the avera of smartphones has become primary to other averas in the Torah. Smartphones is other averas in the Torah. A whole collection of them, some of the most serious ones. It's besides the other issues that get involved, which is just, you know, menschlichkeit issues, people, the waste of time, people get caught up in that, even addiction. There's something called process addictions. People can become addicted, you know, to using, you know, different aspects of the internet. And, you know, I just recently heard a statistic. I don't know if this has to do with addiction, just to do with the smartphones. The statistic was that over the last X number of years, there's been a consistent increase in the number of pedestrian deaths, traffic deaths. And it went up, the last year they had records for, I think it was maybe 2016, it went up 9% from the year before. Why? Because people are on their smartphones and they're walking through the street in front of a car. They're not watching where they're going, watching what they're doing. And, you know, maybe the driver also wasn't watching. Maybe he was also texting. I don't know. But the, so, you know, it's pashut the way it affects people's lives and so on. So it has become a very, very big focus. It is, I think, one of the primary challenges of the generation. You know, and it's not, and it's goofing because we're very concerned about Lashon Hara, and we're very concerned about Gilui Arayos, and we're very concerned about Leitzanus and Bizayon HaTorah and everything else, and we're very concerned about extreme Bittul Zman, and we're concerned about addictions as well. So there is, so that's why it has become such a big focus. And people have to understand that. And again, I do know that you know, technology is here to stay, and the world, you know, it's hard to run the world without it. And we have, you know, but the line we say in Queens is "Kol hamemayit harei zeh meshubach." The less you do, the more praiseworthy. So if you need whatever you might need, you don't need. So that's really. You know, the basis of the thing. We have I don't know what the policies are here. We our policy in Queens right now, in the yeshiva at least, we don't go into people's homes, but we have actually a person in yeshiva who is a skilled IT person who doctors the phones, basically that it doesn't have a browser, cannot really access the internet except for pre-installed apps. So in yeshiva, we only allow a very limited number. We allow, I think, email and Waze, and that's about it. But you know, people who feel they need more than that, maybe should consider having some type of phone that, okay, you need X, Y, Z, put those things on your phone, nothing else. But there is a challenge in many, many ways, and that's why it's important to minimize and putting filters and controls and whatever else if you have to have it. And, you know, it could be, again, you know, I don't know everyone's personal situation, but it could be a bach in yeshiva doesn't really need a smartphone at all. Like, you know, what's the, you know, great. When we first started out with these smartphone ideas, and there was a fellow in the yeshiva, I remember, came to me and says, you know, he was actually very appreciative of how the yeshiva involved discussions with everybody and tried to find out what needs are. He says he's makabel the yeshiva's whatever guidelines, but it's really very hard for him because he really needs the internet. So I said, really, why? He says, I do a decent amount of traveling. I have to buy tickets, airline tickets. You know, it's much easier and much cheaper online. Okay, so how many times do you travel? So he says, maybe 8 times a year. It's okay. What else? He needs to eat, has a special supplement that he has to eat because he has stomach problems. And he orders it online. That's the best place to order it. He says, how often do you order? Once a month. He says, okay. What else? I get this silence, and he's trying to think of what else he really needs the internet for. So I said, so you need, he said, I'm sorry, the number was 6 times a year he traveled. I remember my, so you need the internet for 18 minutes a year. And because of that, you're going to have a smartphone, give you access 24, I'll call it 6. But it's really 7. You're going to give me access and face that, and you send 24 hours a day, every day of the week. For the 18 minutes that you need the internet, now it's not really accurate because you want to buy airline tickets, it usually takes longer than a minute. I have to admit I exaggerated a bit. To buy his supplement probably only took a minute because he knew exactly what he was looking for. He clicks on the thing, puts the order, probably did only take a minute. But the airline tickets probably took longer. But so you need it for, and therefore you should have this Nissan all the time. Listen to me, whenever you need the internet, you'll find it. To be somebody else, you could do. But if worse comes to worse, you're stuck. You come to me. I'll let you use the internet in the office. And he never came to me. So that's the. So we have to keep it in context. Do we really need it or do we want it? You know, like, there's lots of cool things. I'm not denying that. Listen, I have a Navi show that's. It's getting late. It's on the internet. But we didn't put it there. There's this organization that does it, Torah Anytime. I really don't like their slogan. Their slogan is Torah Anytime, God's reason for the internet. I think, no, the real slogan should be Torah Anytime. If you're going to have the internet anyway, at least you might as well learn some Torah on it. That's what I think the slogan should have been. But okay. So I wasn't sure. They asked my permission whether they could put it on. I wasn't so sure whether they should do it or not. So we had it on a Hallel meeting, and the Hallel wasn't so sure either. So we called Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky. So he said yes. He said, his line was very funny. He said, do you know how many shmuzin from Rav Matis Yohu against the internet are on the internet? So he said, it's a third party. So he wouldn't say that the yeshiva should put it on. He said, the third party, there's going to be stuff on the internet anyway, so let there be some Torah there too. So he felt that it was okay to allow him. It's not like anybody's getting themselves internet so they could follow my Navi Shir on TorahAnytime.com. Yeah. That's not happening. So that's what he said. But so there are good things on the internet, but is it worth the risk? Is it worth the nisayon? Yeah, so that's really the problem, and it's something we're struggling with in this generation, and nobody has the easy answers, but it is a priority focus.